I will call this meeting to order of the House Finance and Policy Committee, and note we have a quorum present. First order of business would be approval of the minutes for March 3rd. I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
So moved.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kozlowski. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The motion is approved. With that, I'm going to hand the gavel over to Representative Kozlowski as I've got the first bill up today.
All right, welcome Chair Howard to the Housing Committee. The bill before us is House File 3806. Chair Howard, would you like to move your bill in front of the committee?
I would. I'd move House File 3806 before the committee.
All right, and then members, the plan is to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. All right, Chair Howard, it's your bill.
Members, this is a bill that we've heard in years past. It is a bill to provide housing infrastructure bonds. In particular, this bill calls for $200 million in housing infrastructure bonds to build homes all across the state, especially the homes that Minnesotans are so desperately in need of. We had a great conversation about housing supply and the need for more homes yesterday, especially in sort of the policy realm. And this is really, in the funding realm, our state's bread and butter way to do and meet the goal we all discussed yesterday, which is the need to build more homes, and especially homes that are affordable, both to rent and to own. Since 2012, Minnesota has been a leader across the nation in making investments through the tool of housing infrastructure bonds. And since 2012, we've built 10,000 homes all across the state utilizing this tool. But what we know is that the program is still overprescribed. Commissioner Ho presented a few weeks ago and mentioned this, that for every one proposal that MHFA is able to green light and fund, two are denied. And these are all proposals usually before that are ready to go. They need this housing infrastructure bond funding to be that last push to get shovels in the ground and to build more homes. So when you look at our state's massive housing shortage and the fact that you can leverage such significant investment with housing infrastructure bonds, it is the right move to make an investment that's commensurate with the need. And at $200 million, we can make a considerable investment to build thousands of homes all across the state. And with that, I would turn it over to my testifiers.
Great. It looks like we have three testifiers. First up is Jesse Hendel with Alliance Housing, and then on deck is John Thorson with LIUNA. All right. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here, and you can proceed whenever you're ready.
Okay, thank you. Chair Kozlowski, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Hendel. I'm the Executive Director of Alliance Housing. I'm here today to ask you to support House File 3806 to increase the state's investment in housing infrastructure bonds. Alliance Housing was started in 1991 to make it possible for individuals and families to make home for themselves regardless of their income or background. We believe in creating homes that are affordable, relational, and flexible. Alliance owns and operates 374 homes of deeply affordable housing in Minneapolis. In late 2025, in partnership with Touchstone Mental Health, Alliance opened a supportive housing community called Kyle Garden Square. Kyle Garden Square has 59 homes for chronically homeless adults. Housing infrastructure bonds were a critical source to making the construction of these homes happen in a reality for those 59 Minnesotans. Last week, one of my colleagues had the opportunity to chat with one of our new residents, Pat. Pat will speak at our upcoming grand opening. She is Lakota Sioux, a great-grandmother, and a disabled Air Force veteran. Following the death of her husband in 2022, Pat fell down a hole of addiction. She began experiencing housing instability, and in 2025, Pat entered drug treatment. But after finishing, she returned to homelessness. This is all too common. Being homeless and in recovery is a recipe for relapse. Luckily, Pat met our service partner, Touchstone Mental Health, and with their support, they worked together to get Pat into Kyle Garden Square. Pat is now stably housed and a strong member of the housing community. She looks forward to helping other members of the community access affordable housing in the future. With an investment like $200 million in housing infrastructure bonds, we can build 1,900 more units like Kyle Garden Square to help Minnesotans across the state. Each will be a critical resource, just as those were that Kyle Garden received. I'd be glad to give any members of the committee a tour of Kyle Garden Square. Please feel free to let the staff at MCCD know you'd like a tour. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for being here. All right, and next up we have John Thorson with La Una, Minnesota in North Dakota. And next up will be Chad Adams with Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership on deck. So whenever you're ready for your 2 minutes to begin, you can proceed.
Thank you, Chair Kozlowski, Chair Howard, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Thorson. I'm here on behalf of La Una, Minnesota, North Dakota. We're a union of more than 14,000 proud men and women who build and maintain our state's critical infrastructure. I'm here today to share our support for House File 3806. Minnesota faces a substantial shortage of affordable housing, and like other Minnesotans, the members we represent are finding it increasingly difficult to afford or rent to buy a home in communities they grew up in or choose to live in. The housing crisis in our community is at an all-time high, making it impossible for many people to afford their home or their rent. The shortage of homes for families across income levels increases the pressure on the most vulnerable people in our communities. Too many middle and low-income Minnesotans are finding it hard to and difficult to rent or buy a home, in part because the share of low-cost rental housing in Minnesota has fallen by over a quarter in the last decade, while the cost of buying a home has more than doubled between 2012 and 2022. Minnesota families have been forced to devote a growing share of their household budget to housing. More than 10% of Minnesotans, or over 640,000, are deemed cost burdened, which is defined as housing costs that exceed 30% of a household income. Now, thankfully, state, county, and local governments are stepping up to finance new affordable housing projects through direct grants and tax incentive programs. Yet there's so much more to be done to meet our housing needs. Housing infrastructure bonds are an effective way to leverage federal, local, and private investment to both preserve existing housing and build new affordable housing. We support House File 3806 and the allocation of $200 million for housing infrastructure bonds to move projects forward across the housing continuum in every community, every corner throughout the state. These investments not only help build the housing we need, but they also generate good family-sustaining jobs for our members and many others in the industry. Thank you for your time and consideration of this bill.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you being here. And we'll turn to our last testifier on deck, Chad Adams, who's joining us virtually.
Thank you, Chair Kozlowski and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Chad Adams, and I am the CEO of the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, a nonprofit community development corporation serving 30 counties, which includes over 200 communities across southwest and south central Minnesota. Our organization produces single family and multifamily homes and provides housing services with a mission to partner with communities to develop places for people to call home. Our partnership is a strong supporter of HIBs, as we use the funding to leverage several other sources of dollars, such as private bank financing, city, county, or other federal grants and loans. In our projects, the bonds are never the sole source of funds, but frequently serve as a primary or complementary source to close deals in Greater Minnesota. We appreciate the high degree of flexibility that HIBs can be used for, considering the often very complex deals and other funding requirements that need to be met on projects. One example of our use of housing infrastructure bonds is the preservation and rehabilitation of three apartment buildings in the past 7 years in Wilmer, Alexandria, and one that will be closing this spring in Hutchinson, Minnesota, which represents a total of 104 homes in those communities. Our organization has also used HIBs on the new construction of single-family homes to families below 60% of the area median income. And those homes have recently been placed into our Partnership Community Land Trust in Mankato and will require the homes to be protected and sold to any future affordable home buyer and family for the next 99 years. We again use the housing infrastructure bonds to leverage funding from the city, federal government, and private sector contributions in that situation. Without housing infrastructure bonds, these homes would not have been preserved or built, and we would not have leveraged or received the investment of other funding sources from the private and public sector that help support and grow our local economies in Greater Minnesota. The present investment, however, has not kept up with demand, and Minnesota's experienced an extraordinary housing shortage, especially affordable housing available to households making 50% of area median income or less. In Greater Minnesota, housing is commonly the top priority in every community we serve across our 30-county region. There are dozens of current multifamily properties in our region that need immediate attention to be preserved, and HIBs will help us meet some of those critical needs. I ask that you continue to invest in homes and leveraging other partner funds by passing House File 3806. And I'd like to thank Representative Howard for carrying this bill and for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, we'll move to open to any members of the public who are wishing to testify on this bill. Right. Seeing none, we will move to discussion, member discussion of the bill. All right. Representative Scraba.
Sorry, I didn't hear my name. I apologize. The intent, the $200 million, as you know, I sit on capital investments, and I'm absolutely hell-bent on getting $300 million a year for PFA, Public Finance Authority, so that we can have the infrastructure to support something like this. You know, and I'm kind of in that process thought right now where that if it were to happen, it would be half of what this year's is proposed, $300 for PFA, $200 for housing, and then that leaves $500 to $700 million for HEAPER, other state agency stuff, and it just doesn't seem like there's enough to go around right now for me. Perhaps if it was smaller, I'd be looking at it. But right now, 200, just from my standpoint where I am, I support something like this because this is where it starts. But I want to get everything up to speed for me before I start jumping at it. But thank you.
Thank you, Chair Howard.
Chair Kozlowski, Representative Scraba, I appreciate the word of support for, the tool here and its value and the interaction, you know, for this to really go and help communities, the intersection with public infrastructure is key as well. Housing infrastructure bonds is a different tool per se than general obligation bonding. I get it is all borrowing, but, you know, for a fairly modest sort of debt service, in fiscal year 28-29, additional about $11 million in debt service would be able to leverage, you know, this $200 million investment. But again, I appreciate the support for the concept and recognize that we're going to balance a lot of priorities, but I think this is a pretty important one. And it in a perfect world where yes and, we're doing general obligation bonding on some of those things and investing in HIBs as well.
Representative Scraba, any follow-up?
Oh, no.
Okay. We'll move to Representative Mecklund.
Thank you, Chair. And Chair Howard, do you know in the last – we did these last year, didn't we, as well? But what percentage of these are going to, like, the metro versus the suburbs versus the outstate?
Chair Howard.
Chair Kozlowski, Representative Mecklen, I don't have the exact breakdown in front of me, but in totality, I mentioned the 10,000 number since 2012, and I believe the breakdown is something approaching like 55-45, with 55% or so in the metro area and 45% outside the 7-county metro area. So they have a track record of quite a bit of regional balance. And, you know, a lot of MHFA programs, when they present, they'd kind of talk about that regional balance. And so housing infrastructure bonds is one where they've weighed that quite a bit, and it usually is a commensurate need or an even split, because, of course, there's needs, all across the state. But I could get the exact numbers for you.
Representative Macklin.
Thank you, Chair. Do you know how much we currently have in an outstanding balance on HIBs?
Chair Howard.
Chair Kozlowski, in terms of existing funds that haven't been allocated through, like, their RFP process, is that your question?
Representative Macklin.
Thank you, Chair. What is our balance that hasn't been repaid back? How much, what is our debt service right now on HIBs?
Back to you, Chair Howard.
I might go to our fiscal staff if Ms. Heimer could help us with the exact amount.
Thank you for tapping in. Go ahead.
Chair and members, the current outstanding principal for the housing infrastructure bonds that have been issued is $474.465 million. That is different, of course, than the debt service appropriation that is paid to the agency. So I'm happy to also give that number if that's the number you're looking for.
Representative Macklin.
Thank you, Chair Kozlowski. So at what point, and maybe you should stay for this, I believe we still have a AAA credit rating. What point, if we borrow too much, are we putting that in jeopardy, especially if we end up in a deficit in, you know, the future biennium and not able to make these payments?
Chair Howard.
Chair Kozlowski, Representative Macklin. I mean, I'll take a crack at that. I mean, this has been a really smart tool that I think our credit folks recognize Minnesota's use of, with housing infrastructure bonds that pay kind of dividends in the long run as well. I have not heard of any from our agencies or bond agencies or anything that would sort of say that we're in some sort of risk, a financial position related to kind of the investments we're considering.
Let me follow up, Representative Macklin.
Thank you. Yes, Chair Kozlowski. So one other part to this, and I appreciate that, and maybe you could, if you can find, like, what's the historic high we've ever had of debt service at any one time, you can follow up with that later. But another question, we've seen in the past that some of these dollars are going to things that aren't actually housing, like hockey rinks and tennis courts and things like that. Would you be interested in establishing some type of guardrail that this should be used for, like, critical projects? And, like, right now I'd say housing is probably one of our most critical things. Maybe that's more of a comment than a question, but it does seem kind of absurd that some of these dollars are being shifted into other areas. Thank you.
Chair Howard, did you have any
response? I would just say, Chair Kozlowski, if you have examples of that, I'd love to hear them. But these are housing infrastructure bonds. They have to be used for housing, and they have been used for housing. I mean, there's other forms of bonding through general obligation bonding, et cetera, that have different and more expanded uses. These housing infrastructure bonds go into a process through MHFA to fund housing projects, and as they should.
Thank you, Chair Howard. All right, next we're going to move over to Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Sorry, I'm still a little bit late, but the question I have is regarding those, how much of this could be used towards manufactured homes? They're having different challenges themselves, but it's also a very efficient way of becoming a homeowner too. So thank you.
Chair Howard.
Thank you. Good question, Representative Johnson. Manufactured housing is an eligible use of housing infrastructure bonds, and we have used housing infrastructure bonds for manufactured housing in the past. We don't have a track record of very often earmarking for particular types of housing within the housing infrastructure bonds. But the more investment we put into it, the easier it is for the agency to kind of meet a diversity of needs. I would agree that manufactured housing is and should be a priority with our housing infrastructure bonds dollars. And so, you know, being able to, but, you know, passing a $200 million bill makes it easier than a $20 million bill, as an example.
Back to you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. It's encouraging that you believe that they should. I know I've just heard some challenges that could get tough for to get Minnesota Housing to offer that, or it's tough to get the money out of there. So I think if we started dedicating something towards it, it's more likely that it could go that direction instead of being saying, no, we got something else, maybe we understand better or whatever. But I would just encourage, you know, as we move forward with any bill, or we should start looking at giving some dedicated funds to them, so if inside this. So thank you.
Okay, we'll keep it moving to Representative Hussein.
Thank you, Chair Hauer, for bringing this bill forward. It's an important step forward to address Minnesota housing shortage and strengthen our community across our state. When it comes to housing, the state of Minnesota, the reason I'm sitting in this committee is to address the concern that we heard from our community throughout the state. It doesn't matter whether you are in the greater Minnesota or whether you're in a metro area, housing shortage is affecting everybody's life. If we want a healthy community, we need to build and need to address the concern that we have more. I am in good support in this bill. Thanks for bringing it forward. And we need to just continue working on housings to address the concern that we heard from our community throughout the state to address, because the more we build, the more we have people for them place to stay and have a health community in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Great. And next up we have Representative, Vice Chair Dotsap.
Thank you, Chair Kozlowski, Chair Howard. I like your approach that you actually do whatever it takes, looking at other options that are on the table, throwing all the options out there. I do believe that this approach would open up additional housing infrastructure projects. However, I have some concerns that we look at the long-term debt that it's going to place on the state of Minnesota. Number two is typically housing infrastructure bonds take a longer time to sell. Do you have any feedback on that or response?
Chair Howard.
Vice Chair Dotsap, take a longer time to sell, you know, in the bond market or just?
In the bond market.
I'm happy to gather more information. I haven't heard that concern. In general, housing infrastructure bonds, as compared to other investments we've made in the housing committee, for example, in the 2023 budget, have actually come to fruition quicker than some of the programs that we funded. So the agency has had a pretty strong track record of getting the housing infrastructure bonds, once the legislature passes them, into their RFP and funded. Insofar as our agency is getting the dollars we approve out the door, I think housing infrastructure bonds is a program that's worked well, but I could try to follow up offline specific to your bond market question. I don't have information on that.
Vice Chair Dotsap.
Just a final comment. I just look forward to moving forward with this and having further dialogue as we move forward. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. With no further member dialogue, I'll turn it back to Chair Howard for any closing comments.
Thank you, members. I appreciate the discussion. I appreciate hearing bipartisan support for this tool and its ability to invest in homes and meet what we all say is our number one challenge. It's we got to address our housing supply. We got to do it through policy. We got to do it through investment, and we got to stay persistent. And so thanks for the time. I look forward to having housing infrastructure bonds move forward this year.
Great. And with that, I lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
All right, the second bill on the agenda is House File 2687, Representative Igbaje's bill related to homeownership restrictions for corporate entities. Members, just a little table setting. We had planned to take action on this bill and vote this out Co-Chair Igo, I think, is under the weather, unable to be here today. So we're going to hold the hearing on the bill, lay it over. We will take official action and take a vote on this bill next committee hearing. And so I will move that Representative Gauthier's bill, House Bill 2687, be brought in front of the committee. And I understand that you have a DE1 amendment, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Could you briefly describe it?
Yeah, actually, I can describe it. Otherwise, I mean, it is essentially the new bill, so I don't know if you want to adopt it and then I describe it, or adopt, or describe it and then adopt.
If you could briefly describe it first.
Okay, sure. So the bill as amended now does two things. It limits private equity companies from buying single-family homes completely. And the second part is that it also limits corporations and partnerships from owning more than 50 single-family homes. And the enforcement would happen through the Attorney General's office, and that is what the DE does.
Any questions to the DE? If not, we'll adopt it and then proceed. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE is adopted, and the bill is in the shape the author prefers. Representative Gauthier, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since that was the bulk of it, I'll kind of be brief, but I'll touch on some of the highlights from the conversations we've been having around this bill. So House File 2687 is essentially now narrowed to a bill that would hopefully be a first step to returning the home ownership market back to the people. As I just briefly described, the bill now only limits private equity companies from buying single-family homes, and it also limits corporations and partnerships from owning more than 50 single-family homes, and enforcement would happen through the Attorney General's office. So this bill in this form is focused on the simplest part of this discussion to lay a foundation that we can build upon in the future. Home ownership in Minnesota is something that continues to be out of reach for Minnesotans of color and working Minnesotans. The reasons are varied, but corporate ownership of single-family homes is definitely a factor. According to reports from the Federal Reserve, Pew Charitable Trust, and reporting done by the Star Tribune, corporate entities are purchasing more homes in the marketplace to the detriment of many first-term home buyers. Corporate ownership doubled their share of the market beginning in 2026, and while some of the research that the Minneapolis Fed has done is beginning to show some stabilization in those purchases, when you dig deeper, you see that investor purchases are still concentrated in low-income neighborhoods. Communities like Northeast Minneapolis and the suburbs of Fridley and Hopkins, in those areas, corporate home ownership of single-family homes was as high as 30%, 24%, and 27%, respectively. In many of those areas, the share of large corporate owners is still growing. So this means that in those communities, families and working people are unable to compete with corporate owners who can offer cash and forego inspection fees or pay tens of thousands of dollars over the asking price. This leaves working Minnesotans the only option to rent from these corporate landlords if they want to stay in the neighborhood. And over time, that could lead to a concentration of poverty or a lack of amenities in that neighborhood. And part of the reason why a bill like this is necessary to begin to address the issue of corporate owners, who sometimes can be absentee landlords, those landlords then have limited property management oversight, and they don't address and respond to repairs in a timely fashion. So we also hear stories from people that say that sometimes the only time you hear from one of these corporate landlords is when the rent is due. And some of the most egregious issues we saw a couple of years ago with Havenbrook Homes out in Minneapolis. By limiting the amount of single-family homes that corporate entities can own, hopefully we can have more homeowners that are present in their communities and building their wealth. And with that, I'll turn to testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Gauthier. I'm looking for my first testifier who I don't see, so I'm going to go next to Ellen Solly. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair and members. My name is Ellen Solly. I'm president of the Family Housing Fund. The Family Housing Fund is a 46-year-old organization that helps communities address their housing challenges. And one of the areas of our work has been in the area of single-family rentals. We have done a few things in this area, and informing our work is the renter experience of living in single-family rental homes. We worked with the University of Minnesota Center for Urban and Regional Affairs on two research projects. And in 2024, we worked with a national organization called the Private Equity Stakeholders Project to understand the role of private equity in the Minnesota market. And through this research, we wanted to understand what works well and what the challenges are for renters, as well as understand who the players are in this asset class. First, we broke up the ownership into categories based on size of their portfolio. Micro owners own one unit, small owners own 2 to 5 units, medium owners own 6 to 20 units, and then large owners own more than 20 units in this single family asset. And in our data set of 42,000 single family rentals, 86% of the owners are micro or small owners, 5% are medium owners, and about 8.5% represent this large ownership of 20 units, and are more traditional owners or investors, as well as REITs and private equity. And we learned a couple of things that are really important as you consider this legislation. The first is there is a tipping point for effective single-family rental property management. And as the portfolio size increases beyond 14 units, the renter experience declines, deteriorates significantly. Rents rise consistently as the portfolio size increases, and specifically renters of large owners, large landlords in that 20 unit and more, report rents of more than $200 per unit compared to the micro units. And almost 2/3 of the renters living in large landlord homes reportedly noticed the need for repairs immediately upon moving in, and further reported a reduced responsiveness on the part of their landlord when they've reported repairs. So from our experience and our research, the single family data suggests large landlords of more than 20 units of single family rental are the most disruptive and difficult in the rental market. The proposed legislation focuses on private equity and investor owners of more than 50 units of single family rentals, and it's an important step of managing the most troublesome part of this asset class while still allowing for renter choice in those that want to live in a single family rental home. So we support this legislation and appreciate your leadership on it. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Mark Bruner, Minnesota Manufactured Home Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. I'm Mark Bruner. I'm president of the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. MMHA is celebrating its 75th anniversary as a trade association this year, so we've certainly seen a lot of changes over the years in terms of our homes and business model. There are approximately 900 manufactured home communities in the state of Minnesota that are licensed by the Department of Health. There are about 15 plants that build manufactured and modular homes in Minnesota. We're the largest source of non-subsidized attainable housing in the state. We have a couple concerns with the bill, and I have previously expressed those to the author, so it's not a surprise. And actually, to put our concerns in perspective, 80% of all manufactured homes sold in Minnesota go on private property or as real estate. The other 20% go in manufactured home communities or on leased land. So essentially the scope of the bill, we're not here to argue against the manufactured homes that are on private property being included. However, we do believe that there needs to be a separation for manufactured home communities or manufactured home parks, that where the homes are considered single family homes, they're taxed at a class rate of 1% as a site built home is. However, they're on leased land. And so it's our belief that to alleviate any confusion that manufactured home park communities should fall under the exceptions as well as a couple of the others that are listed there, and we think the language right now is too broad, but that, you know, we have manufactured home communities who do have rental homes. You know, on occasion there may be a vacancy, and for cash flow purposes they need to, you know, make sure that they have an income stream, so they may have a rental home, that kind of thing. So the bill doesn't, you know, necessarily preclude, you know, them from being brought in on that basis because they have a rental home that they've acquired versus single family homes, which is really the intent of the bill. So what we're seeking is just that exception or carve out for manufactured home communities, not homes themselves on private property. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Paul Egger, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs with the Minnesota Realtors. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Paul Egger. I'm Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. Just to share a few thoughts about the housing market that are relevant to the topic addressed in Representative Bajaj's bill today. Also, just we want to share just a few concerns with the policy approach taken here with market prohibitions and restrictions. And then finally, I just want to leave you with a few thoughts on some alternative approaches that you may want to consider moving forward. I would also like to thank Representative Egbaje for her generosity and time. She has had an open door over the years as she's worked on this issue and other issues, and I really appreciate it, and I look forward to continuing the dialogue as we move forward. Minnesota Realtors supports getting more Minnesotans into home ownership. It's a priority that I've testified about in front of this committee over the years. It's a priority that we've worked with Representative Egbaje specifically and members of this committee through the development of the First Generation Home Buyers Down Payment Assistance Program. It's a priority that we want to continue to work with the legislature on moving forward. But just a few thoughts about the housing market that I think are relevant to the bill before you today. First, just history is a guide. We have a market right now that this committee is well aware after the discussions the past couple of weeks, especially yesterday, that's characterized by low inventory and high demand that's driving up prices because supply isn't able to meet that demand. However, we also learned in the aftermath of the 2008 housing crash what happens when there are not enough buyers for the supply that ends up on the market in a difficult economy. That means single-family homes can go through foreclosure, sit vacant, or fall into disrepair. Markets are cyclical. We haven't always had a low inventory and high demand situation like we have today, and the market will not always be like this. And we believe that buyers and sellers both benefit from having a free and open real estate market. We want to just urge some caution in assuming that any investor purchased property would simply have been purchased by an owner-occupant. Some properties purchased by investors need significant work before they're ready to go to market. And then just to share a few concerns with the market prohibitions and restrictions. You know, this bill would change state law to address concerns with the current market. At some point, this market will shift, and MNR believes that the policy response to this bill could create unintended consequences. Having a real estate market that does not prohibit or restrict investors can be beneficial to sellers, particularly when that buyer demand drops. There are also situations that arise for individuals and families. Think of situations where there's a divorce or a job loss or a transfer to another part of the country where a timely sale and immediate closing is critical. And sometimes an investor is the only party that is willing to take on that property at that point in time. Our realtor members often tell me, too, that there are situations in every market, no matter how high demand is and low inventory is, that a property just doesn't sell. And so in those situations, sometimes an investor is the only party willing to take on the risk, put in the effort to bring that property up to the point that it will be ready to offer up in the real estate market. And finally, Mr. Chair, just real briefly, we would encourage you to consider all different options for addressing the concerns that this bill is attempting to address. And some of those ideas that we'd like to share with you include a capital gains tax exemption for investors who sell single-family homes to owner-occupant buyers, a corporate income tax credit per unit sold to owner-occupants, a deed tax exemption for investors selling to owner-occupants, continued investment in first-time and first-generation homebuyer assistance to help those buyers be more competitive in the market. And then finally, this committee had a great discussion yesterday on the Starter Homes Act. That's probably the best way to minimize the role of investors in the market is to increase the supply of housing. So again, thank you for the time to share with you our thoughts on this bill and this issue. And again, look forward to continuing the conversation with Representative Bagé throughout the session. Thank you.
Thank you. That is the list of folks. Virtually, we have Rachel Ruby Jones, a Minneapolis resident, who's going to testify virtually.
Hi, good afternoon, Chair Howard and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Jones, and I am testifying today in support of HF 2687, as I have firsthand experience renting from a private equity landlord, an experience that has thoroughly changed my life. I signed a lease with Havenbrook in February of 2019 to move into a single family rental home in North Minneapolis, even though it was apparent that the property was not well cared for. However, I was in a vulnerable position. I had a toddler, I was pregnant, and was finally leaving an abusive relationship. I needed stable housing quickly, and I felt I had few realistic options. I remember signing the lease with little time to consider alternatives. Soon after moving in, serious problems began. One Saturday afternoon in the spring, as the snow was beginning to melt, the basement started to flood. I called the emergency line as it was the weekend. After speaking with someone in a call center in Georgia, I was informed they would reach out to management. When I was finally contacted by management, I was told there would be no repair until the weekend or until after the weekend. I was asked to wait while water continued to flood my basement, and it remained in my home. At the same time, management also directed me to keep an extension cord running along the basement floor that was plugged and have it plugged in continuously to a humidifier, despite my lease explicitly prohibiting any electrical cord running along the basement floor. Looking back, it's starkly comical how ridiculous the situation was. If it were not for the fact that I was literally scared of electrocution for myself, but most especially for my toddler. Over the next 2 years, the unit had repeated habitability and safety issues. One thing I vividly remember from all the fighting with the company was when I would finally reach a real life person on the other end of the phone, I was treated with such disdain. It was like it was my fault for not being able to afford my own home. Just another renter, just a person to farm rent money from. After 2 years of unresolved issues, I joined a lawsuit against the company because reporting problems produced no meaningful repairs or accountability. My experience was not isolated. Many neighbors, especially BIPOC families using rental assistance and subsidies, renting from the same company as me, experienced worse conditions. They were actually amazed I occasionally talked to someone in management. I know a mother whose child suffered lead poisoning while living in one of the company's homes. The company's defense was that they had provided informational material about lead and therefore were not responsible. Renters as profit centers, nothing more. From my perspective, private equity ownership creates a perverse incentive. Properties are treated as assets to be optimized for investors rather than as homes that require timely maintenance, safe conditions, and accountability to residents. When maintenance is deferred, costs and risks are shifted onto tenants, many of whom are low income, have limited mobility or lack of resources to pursue remedies. The result is increased health risks, more housing instability, and families forced to endure substandard living conditions. I urge you to consider the human impact behind these ownership practices and pass HF2687 to help ensure homes are managed with accountability and to prevent companies that prioritize profit over people from owning single family residences. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in attendance that would like to testify? If not, we can move on to member discussion. And first on the list, I have Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Agbaje, I will say that you've changed the bill quite a bit since we first saw this, and I appreciate that. But I will say that it still presupposes that this is a problem that is more than just anecdotal. And if you'll remember, members, and with the chair's indulgence, we did pass out an article from Jerusalem Demsis, who I believe used to write, I think she's moved on somewhere else, for The Atlantic, which is not exactly known as a far right-wing polemic rag. It is anything but that. And I just want to say that this is not, in my estimation, the problem that it's being made out to be. And I know you've elevated it, the number of houses to 50, and I appreciate that. But I just want to stand up for just the idea that this is happening en masse, because I don't believe it is. And I don't believe that my vote will ever be secured to effectively be limiting the free market in the way that this does. So I will say, and I'm not going to go through it page by page, Mr. Chair, because I'd probably get gaveled down. But I would encourage members to read this article, because it is quite illustrative, and I think it is an antipode to the argument that Representative Agbaje is making. I do have one particular question to the bill, if Chair, you would. I would like to ask Representative Agbaje, lines 3.4 through 3.5 through 3.6 of your DE. Could you detail the mechanism with which the Attorney General may enforce this section pursuant to 8.31? Because in your last version of the bill, I believe that the Attorney General could force sale of, if this language were to happen, if you had 52 houses, those could be forced into auction over the objection of the owner and without any delay.
Representative Bajie?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash. So to answer your question, right now what it is the enforcement would kind of happen through the ways the Attorney General sort of alerted to issues or violations of law. So it would have to be people or renters or other business owners that know that someone is violating the law alert the Attorney General, in the same way that the Havenbrook situation happened to their office. In previous language, we did have a more robust structure of divestiture, which I'm hoping that if this moves on to the next committee hearing, that we can have more of a conversation there of what a divestiture schedule would look like. I have heard that it needs to be longer, and so, you know, hopefully there could be language that shows a longer time period and a different mechanism of how people would have to divest if they went over the limit. And Mr. Chair, if you would, to the earlier comments, yes, there are a number of articles, including the Atlantic article. I have read other articles that try to downplay the issue. And while on a number scale, yes, compared to everything, you could say these are low numbers. But what we are seeing that is happening in other states around the country is the fact that people are being closed out of this market because there are buyers there who really can just pay cash, pay tens of thousands of dollars over the asking price. Or what they also do is they buy up huge swaths of neighborhoods and ensure that the people who then live in those neighborhoods are only renters and they're not building any personal wealth for themselves. And so while we can, you know, quibble on the fact of how big of a problem is it? Is it actually a problem? How much of an effect does it have on the market? One of the things that we do know is that when people feel a certain way particularly in economics, that actually really dictates a lot of their behaviors in that market. And so if we want to continue to promote home ownership for people, I think we need to take out one of the barriers that people are looking at and seeing is a barrier to them getting their first home.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to press the point, Representative Agbaje, again. What is the mechanism of divestiture? Because unless you haven't developed that and you're doing it at the next committee stop, but I don't have 8.31 in front of me or committed to memory. You might. But is it forced sale through the Attorney General, as was in the last iteration of the bill?
Representative Baje.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dash, no. So the enforcement mechanism through the Attorney General's office is there would be a lawsuit, and then it would be a remedy that they find appropriate. So with in the Havenbrook situation, they found that the appropriate remedy was a divestiture and a movement of those properties. But in other cases, you know, they could decide, say, if someone is at 51 or 52, that perhaps, you know, there's some other way for them to get into compliance, or maybe they could pay something to the state, or if there's harm done to a renter in that situation, maybe, you know, there's something there. So, but we will need to, and which is why I'm hoping that we can get to the next committee, flesh that out a little bit more, because I too would also want it to give a little bit more directive to the Attorney General's office rather than just what they deem would be an effective remedy.
Anything further, Mr. Nash?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure I heard you would like for the Attorney General to be able to force people into auction. Okay, we'll talk offline. Question for you or nonpartisan. Your effective date is set at August 1st, 2026. And it appears, and I just want to clarify this for the record and for anybody who may get caught up in this, your bill, were it to become law, only applies to situations that happen after August 1st of 2026. So I could have 400 houses prior to this, and you're not going to send the Attorney General to make me pare down to 50?
Representative Baje.
Mr. Chair, under this language, we would not be able to do that. It's a forward-looking bill. So this is why moving forward, we would want to talk about divestiture, because that could be something that could address purchases that were made before the effective date that are over the limit. But in this current language right now, no, it would only be future looking.
Question for the chair.
Representative Nash.
You're laying this over, and we're going to have another time where we take this up and discuss it, or is it your intention to wait for Chair Igo to return and then just vote it out, or what is your desired pathway for this? Because, as you know, I'm deeply troubled by this, so I want to make sure that we have a full-throated conversation, and I would like to know what the pathway when you bring this back is intended.
Thanks, Representative Nash. I want to talk with my co-chair about exact path, but as I think we'll have a full hearing today, and you can anticipate when I have the gavel next, we'll bring this bill up. I guess we'll see how the conversation goes today. If, you know, Co-Chair Igo hasn't had a chance to weigh in, so potentially we can have more discussion, but the hope would be to have a vote and hopefully move the bill on in the process at our next hearing.
And, Mr. Chair, where would you refer it to, and what is the maybe the author knows, what is the proposed number of committee stops that this would have to be?
I think the motion will be to send to Judiciary, but I don't know if Representative Agbaje has anything additional in terms of committee stops.
The committee path is Housing and Judiciary.
Representative Nash.
Curious as to whether it would have to go to Commerce, given that you're regulating commerce in a way. So, when we talk about online, but seems to me that that would be a very logical stop along the way. But once again, I appreciate the work. I really do. When this first came to us, it was a very aggressive bill, and I recognize and commend the work, but I'm still not there and don't anticipate getting there. But you gave it a good run. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you, Chair. So I thank you for this article from The Atlantic, Meet the Latest Housing Crisis Scapegoat. I'm looking at the top of page 7. It says, housing is primarily unaffordable in this country because of a persistent undersupply. So now I have another piece of evidence that supports that we have a lack of supply of housing. And our bill, our Starter Homes Act yesterday, really helps with that.
Always on message, Representative Rayer Hour. I appreciate that very, very much.
Okay. But that being said, we may not have that. That is like the problem of why we have high cost of housing. We know it's still a small percent of private equity that owns these homes in Minnesota, but we do have the beginning of a problem. And we have seen this buying up by corporations be a problem in specific neighborhoods in Minnesota, and we have seen it in other states. So because of that, I really do think it is our work, and which is why I'm glad that you have this bill here and I support this bill. I think it's our work to prevent problems, not to wait for them to become a big problem and then try to go backwards. So I'm so excited to be on the front end of this to potentially prevent this being a big problem in Minnesota by putting some of these guardrails on private equity buying housing. So I support the bill. Thank you very much.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Howard, Representative Raybauer. We do agree on the one thing that's nice to agree is that we are lacking housing. Where we don't agree on is how we fix that. So thank you, Representative Bajaj. I have just a few questions, basically. One of them is I remember back in 2008, I was working for a plumbing company that did a lot of remodeling and stuff like that. And at the day, during the day, private equity was coming in and seen as heroes, because we had most of our business was done in St. Paul and Minneapolis, and they were devastated. I mean, there was neighborhoods that nobody invested in. These homes were not livable. They were all condemned and all that stuff, and the only people buying them were with private equity. So my concern is, how far away are we from the next housing crisis and the same thing happens and nobody has the money but these companies to come in and do that? So I think we always have to go back to history and realize history always repeats itself, and then all of a sudden we're in a situation where nobody can address that. But that built into the question I had is, these are the people who it does not apply to. Is companies primarily building or rehabilitating homes? Now, again, the private equity companies were coming in and buying the homes and rehabilitating them and then either turning them into rentals because nobody was there to buy them, or they did sell them. So then would that, if a private equity company came in and remodeled it or rehabbed a home, are they exempt? And how long would they be exempt for?
Representative Ibaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I think you're looking at the exceptions that show up on 2.29, and it was the first time we have it, 1.16. So we specify it's a nonprofit organized under Chapter 317A, so not a private entity. So again, the private equity company and the corporation would not be exempt from the work that they do of rehabbing and reselling them. So it would only be the nonprofit organization.
Can I ask Representative Bajaj, I guess this is a numbers game, but if somebody had 40, they rehabbed something and then sold it, they would have one less, right? You're saying if it's above 50.
Only if it's above 50 or if they meet the private equity definition.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. What would be, and I know Representative Nash was kind of going down that line, is right now this is a forward-looking bill, but you said you kind of gave the impression that future views of this would possibly go backwards to people who already own them. So I guess I'm really wondering is, depending upon the time of the market and where the market is, what would be the timeline for sale? And say the private equity company started trying to sell and nobody's buying, would they then be forced to keep reducing the price until they got somebody to buy it? Or what would be the plan there?
Representative Labate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Johnson. So as I stated, the divestiture schedule is still being worked on, so there's many different ideas and many different ways to do it. Some of the ideas that have been presented to me talk about a lengthy timeline, anywhere around 4 or 5 years. I've also heard ideas around the fact that perhaps only a certain number of private equity sales would be allowed in the market per year. So then if you know, once that quota is met, they wouldn't be able to sell anymore. There's also opportunities that we've talked about of maybe ensuring that if there's a renter in the home already, that family has the first opportunity to purchase if they're able to. So there's a variety of ways to kind of do that piece of it, but there, you know, and even your suggestion of decreasing the price could be part of it, but we don't have a specific mechanism yet. And so when that's developed, I'm happy to talk more about
you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer. I guess, Representative Nash touched on, what we're discussing is a lot of things that haven't been worked on yet. And those are the ones that concern me, because what is the plan going forward? Because I don't think we're getting enough information. And my concern, too, is just looking forward, is I think that's one of our jobs, is to look forward, what if and what may happen, is the people who are renting are the ones that will be harmed. And the fact that we received a notice, we must divest, I know you can't buy it, so now you're going to have to find other housing, and all of a sudden we have now some people that are homeless, and now we have to figure out how do we help them. And so my concern would be trying to force people to sell would create some victims that they're very innocent, and that would be my concern. So thank you.
Thank you, President Johnson. Vice Chair Dotson.
Thank you, Chair Howard, Representative Abadje. This bill's gone a long ways. I remember when it first came in front of us, and you've worked hard to get it to where it's at, so I respect that and I appreciate that. The question I've got is sometimes we have to be careful what we wish for. As we're moving forward here, I think Representative Johnson had touched a little bit about that. One side, we're asking for more housing, for more rental units. With this taking place, we've actually seen that there have been more housing units provided. Are we creating a problem by eliminating that opportunity to take place? If I recall back in, I believe it was 2008, 2009, I don't remember which administration that was actually encouraging hedge funds to come in and actually purchase and acquire rentals and get them on the market just so we can clean up the market, the real estate market. With that said, the question I've got, can you give more of a clarity on private equity? Would that affect LLCs, more small private landlords as well?
Representative Igbaje.
Yes. So the private equity definition that we have is one that focuses on companies that are focused on raising and returning capital for investment, development, or disposure of specific assets. So that's a really higher level class of company. On the corporation side, we are looking at those partnerships, corporations, real estate investment trusts, managed funds. And so these are also going to be these larger corporations. To the question of like the rental market, I mean, there will still be a rental market. Obviously, the limit here is 50. So if you're a corporation and you have, 45 homes in your portfolio that you're renting, that is still going to be part of the rental market. We'll have a number of corporations that do that. We'll also have the small mom and pop shops that own one or two or three units that rent out. So we'll want to make sure that there's like a good mix. But what we're doing is this bill is laying a foundation to ensure that some of the biggest players that can buy up huge swaths at one time and really kind of close out the market for some of these smaller investors, these small mom and pop shops and individuals, that they're no longer in the playing field. And speaking to different federal administrations that have kind of tried to play in the housing market, our current federal administration right now is actually saying that they don't want private equity and hedge funds in the single family home housing market. So I think there's actually, interestingly enough, some good alignment there with our federal government in the path forward that people would like to see.
Anything further, Representative Dotson?
Just a final comment. Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative Abadji, I look at working more on this, and actually I think we can get somewhere that as we see things are migrating in the right direction, but we're not there. So let's have more discussion offline on this. Thank you.
Vice Chair Kozlowski.
Thanks, Chair Howard and Rep. Agbaje for bringing this bill forward. You know, I think the fact that we just had a bill for investing in more public housing and then to come right back to the juxtaposition of now we're tackling private equity and corporate ownership in housing just speaks to the issue that in Minnesota we have 95% privatized housing. Of course, myself and many believe that housing is a human right, not a commodity for highest bidder. So I really appreciate the work on this front. I am a big fan of the private equity stakeholder project. If you go to their website, you can actually track the private equity industry and just their whole model of business that's really upside down, making it upside down for Minnesotans and Americans across housing. They're gobbling up healthcare. I would also say they're trying to buy our public goods. They are stomping on our public energy utilities. And I can say that as a community that just had our public utility turned over to a private equity as a warning shot that this is not the way that is going to be the best serving for Minnesotans by way of transparency. We see what they do across all of these industries in rent hikes, that they cut workers' wages, you know, just on and on and on. And you may recall when we talked about corporate landlord ownership, was it two sessions ago, 23? I don't know, it all blurs together. At that time in Duluth, we were dealing with the Cheerios challenge, if you recall. We had a billionaire in Kathy Cargill who bought up over 24 houses and parcels right on Park Point, which is pristine area with some of the best single family homes that she called pieces of crap. And she said we peed in her Cheerios because Duluthians stood up to say that this is not the way forward. We do not want this corporate ownership. We want these homes for people in our community, for young people to be able to stay here, for workers looking to work in our manufacturing and other industries. And what happened? She turned around and demolished all of those properties, and they're all sitting now either torn down or sitting vacant. And when we scan out nationally for private equity, I think it's pretty interesting that we have a president who I would not normally agree with, but on this topic we find common ground just as the Yes to Homes package. So whether you're for this administration or you're more like Zoran Mondani, I think it's pretty interesting when we come together and bring our sides. And this is one. Private equity owns 2.5 million units nationwide, and that's actually 10% of our housing in the country. We've seen them gobble up multifamily, single-family homes, manufactured. And I quote from a letter from Blackstone to their investors in 2023, "The structural shortage of housing has resulted in pricing power of rental assets." We'll also note that Blackstone is utilizing and colluding with RealPage and YieldStar software that's working to set rent price hikes across their properties. And that comes from lawsuits in Washington to Arizona to North Carolina. And I'll also note that, you know, on average, they've increased rents at 38%. They've ramped up evictions as well as foreclosures. And so I think this just speaks to, and I know you're working on it, a divestment plan, bringing forward work around just cause, as well as the work that we have to ban this corporate collusion. And I'll just end with a quote from our president that he wrote and noted, you know, after indicating that he's going to take steps to ban this institutional investment, that Blackstone stock fell 5.6%, and I think that speaks to Americans see through the BS. But in this post, you know, Trump said people live in homes and not in corporations, and I agree. So thank you.
Just make a few comments before we go to the bill. Representative Kozlowski, you stole my bit. I was going to read from our president as well, and you know, maybe we cut this tape for us. You know, Democrats reading saying supportive things about President Trump, but. This could be an area for us to work in a bipartisan fashion centered around the power imbalance for regular folks trying to get to the American dream. And we talked a lot about that yesterday. It's too hard. It's too hard because we don't have enough homes, and it's also too hard because the deck stacked against regular folks when they're trying to purchase a home. As Representative Bajie mentioned, we've heard story after story of folks getting outbid by all cash offers by these large entities. And I do think this is a problem now, by the way. We have entire suburban communities, as reported by the Star Tribune, that have upwards of 20-30% of their homes being owned by private business and entire communities. And we see in other regions of the state a huge concentration of this. And so it really behooves of us to get ahead of the problem, one that is still here, in a way that just puts more power and agency into all of our constituents. That is the core of this bill and why I think it's important. And I would say this is a pretty modest version of this bill. We're just talking about targeting the largest of the large actors here, you know, and I think there's a lot of ways we could even increase more power in the hands of Minnesotans, like creating a true opportunity to purchase so that it's regular folks that have the first crack at buying a home, not some faceless mega corporation. And so I appreciate the work on this bill. I think it's important. Just vote with your president, and we can move this one forward. Representative Bajie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. I always like bringing this bill forward because we get lots of really good discussion, and I always think we get a little bit of movement. So, Nash, we may get you there eventually. But I would just want to kind of close and say we are more and more seeing that the United States as a whole is definitely a playground for corporations. In many areas of life, they have found ways to continue to extract as much wealth from poor and working class people as much as possible. And unfortunately, one of the ways that they've decided to do that is through our housing. Our housing, where it should be a safe place for us to go home to, a refuge, a place for us to recharge, a place for us to actually start to build our own wealth. But instead, they have decided that they took advantage of a situation after the financial crisis in 2008-2009, and they've never left the marketplace. And so they've decided that they can buy up as many houses as they want, rent them back to us, and keep raising the price until who knows when. And so I'm hopeful that something like this can be a good foundational starter of figuring out when do we bring the homeownership marketplace back to real people, back to families. You know, Minnesota can be leading on this, and in fact, there are many other states, even red states like Iowa and Kentucky, that are also looking at banning private equity and large corporations from buying up the homes in their states as well. And so I hope that Minnesota will continue to lead on this conversation and that we'll find a place that hopefully enough of us will be supportive of and we can continue to build on from there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bajie. We'll see you next week.
In 5 minutes.
yeah. Oh, that's right. Stay up there. See, you can never quit the Housing Committee, Representative Bajie. But we will lay the bill over and plan to take it up next week. And next we have House File 497.
Okay.
And I understand. Well, first I'll move your bill before the committee. We'll also, I understand you have an A1 amendment, so I'll move your A1 amendment. Would you briefly describe it?
Yes, the A1 amendment makes the appropriation for year 2027 because we've already made a budget for year 2026.
So. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The A1 is adopted. And members, the plan is to hear this bill and lay it over for possible inclusion. Representative McBodger, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, House File 497, is an appropriation of $2.2 million to the Community Mediation Minnesota, who provide free and low-cost mediation services to those in need in housing court. This statewide program helps people stay in their homes by working with landlords and renters to come to a good resolution. The work that CMM does supports the broader goal of keeping people in their homes. While most landlords and tenants have good relationships, even the best relationships, things happen, and having a neutral third party work through conflict on issues like non-payment, repairs, disputes between neighbors, it helps create a beneficial solution for both parties. Mediation can also prevent evictions, which we know are disruptive and traumatic. And by engaging in mediation, landlords and renters can avoid costly court fees and the detrimental long-term effects of an eviction appearing on a tenant's record. Using this mediation is voluntary, and this bill will allow that option to be accessible to more people. And with that, I'd like to bring up the testifiers.
Our first testifier is Katie Arnold, Co-Executive Director of Community Mediation Minnesota. And I think joining her will be Beth Bailey, Executive Director of Community Mediation Restorative Services. Sure. Welcome to you both to the committee.
Thank you.
Chair Howard, thank you so much. Committee members and Representative Agbaje, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Stable Housing Mediation. There are some familiar faces. We've been here for the last 7 years, I think, but an awful lot of new faces. So I'm going to talk a little bit about just mediation in general. I'm Beth Bailey. I'm the Executive Director of Community Mediation and Restorative Services. Hennepin County is our main geographic area, and I've been with the organization for 32 years. So housing mediation was the first chapter in my mediation career in Minnesota, and it's what I'm so passionate about as I'm on the other bookend of my career here. Appreciate the opportunity to bring this to you. I want to talk about three different things, and the first is why mediation, the second is why housing mediation, and then the third is why the structure of this bill. And I'll ask our co-executive director of Community Mediation Minnesota, Katie Arnold, to speak to that. First, why mediation? And I want to share a core belief of mediators, a core value for us is self-determination. We believe that people have the capability of resolving their own disputes, and the people who are living with the conflict are best suited to resolve those conflicts. It's at the last resort we should turn to our government, our courts, to ask them to make a decision about our lives. People have the ability to resolve most of the disputes that they are living with. They have the wisdom to know, communities have the wisdom to know. What's the best solutions for those? So there's a core belief of self-determination. I want to make sure that we don't confuse mediation with arbitration. Mediation is a voluntary process. The mediators have no authority to make decisions for people. We are in the room to help that conversation go better so that they can find a mutually beneficial resolution. It's also often confused with compromise, and while give and take is helpful, it's not compromise where we're cutting things in half. And mediation training, we often use the story of the two kids who are fighting over the orange, parent doing the fair thing of cutting it in half. In mediation, we're going to get beyond why everybody thinks that they have the right to that orange, and instead we're going to find out, why is that important to you? Why do you want that orange? And we find out one party wants the peel and one party wants the orange, and we let them figure out that I could have the entire peel because I don't want the inside. You could have the entire inside. So it's getting people beyond those positions and into, why is this important to you? And helping people do some of that creative, out-of-the-box thinking. So I know when we talk about conflict, conflict has a lot of negative connotations. People usually think negatively about conflict. It robs us of our peace of mind. It robs us of resources. We get stuck. Our relationships are often harmed by conflict. So there's reason to have negative connotations around conflict. But conflict in and of itself is not a bad thing. It is often an indicator that we care. You could say that apathy is the opposite of conflict. When you all as a committee find yourselves in conflict over something, it's because you care and because you care deeply. And there's an energy that comes from conflict, and there's that energy that comes from caring. And conflict is often provides us the catalyst to move into something that needed to be addressed and to move forward with something. So we see conflict as positive, but only when we have a process to address it. So when we are in conflict and when the conflict involves us, we're usually at our worst. We aren't thinking creatively. We have a harder time hearing, and that's where the mediators come in. And the role of the mediator is to help people hear and be heard, to be seen and to see. And there's something incredibly powerful in being heard and in being seen. And the mediator's role is to do that. When the mediators come in, well, let me mention, in every one of your communities, you all represent your own community. Every one of our communities across the state of Minnesota has conflict. And every one of our communities has the peacemakers. These are the individuals, you know these people. Conversations go better when they're in the room. It might be they don't say anything, but all of a sudden they'll ask a question, and the way they ask that question makes everybody see the problem in front of them a little bit differently. When they are in the space, when they are in the conversation, people feel a little bit safer. They know that this isn't going to go off the wall. So these are our people, these mediators. And somebody asked me once, can you really teach somebody to be a mediator in a 30-hour training? And I say no, but by spending 30 hours with people, I can usually tell if they have the stuff we can't teach, if they have that ability to diffuse, if they have the ability to elevate dignity, if they have ability to help people be seen and be heard. One of the techniques that we use in the mediation process is called uninterrupted time. At the very beginning of a mediation, we lay out the structure of how that conversation's going to go, and then we invite parties to have uninterrupted time. They can tell their story in their own order without prompts of questions. They can talk about what's important to them. And then as soon as they're done, the other person has a chance to do that. And just giving and allowing this conversation to have that 10 minutes of time, humanity seeps into the room. People start to be seen. People start to be heard. And then something happens where they can shift into a problem solving. I see so many conversations between landlords and tenants, for example, where it's very transactional, and they start right in the, this is the amount that's due, and when are we going to address this? And they don't take that 10 minutes to allow people to be human in that space. Once people have that, they can shift into problem solving. But if they don't have that to begin with, I see people signing negotiated agreements with their attorneys involved that they never intend to keep. They're going through the process at that time because they didn't have the opportunity to become a human being, to become a person with a story. Our job at the Community Dispute Resolution Program is to take those people who are facing a conflict and pair them up with our wonderful volunteer mediators and our staff who are trained and serve and step in that role of mediators. So we're a matchmaker in a way between those in conflict and those with the skills to help people in conflict. So why housing mediation? And I'm going to share one of my earlier experiences. This is in January of 1994, and it was such a consequential day for me, and it's probably the reason I'm here today. I went into housing court in Hennepin County for the very first time, and I was there to provide mediation services. And I remember that day so clearly, walking into that courtroom that was shoulder to shoulder, standing room only. It was packed with people. I observed the process and realized the stories didn't matter. The judge really had very little authority in being able to address the reason that people were there. And things happen very quickly. People go from being housed to homeless very quickly in that. I also learned during the course of that hearing, I had seven different people come up to me and say, I'd like to mediate. And I'd say, let's go find your tenant. And we'd go out in the hallway. And in each of those seven occasions, each of those seven conversations, I watched these people use that space to come up with an agreement that worked for them. And I often tell people now in that mediation space, in this moment, before you go before the bench, you have more authority than the judge does. You can work out some kind of arrangement with each other that the judge cannot order. A judge cannot provide you with more than 7 days to redeem the property. A judge cannot allow a move-out schedule that you have in mind. A judge cannot order a payment plan. But you, as individuals, have the authority. You have the power in this moment to be able to come up with that in a mediated agreement. And the judge will review that agreement with you, and the judge can make that agreement the order. But the judge cannot order. The judge cannot do what you can do.
Ms. Bailey, I might ask you to wrap up soon so we have time for some member questions.
Yes, discussion. Yes. So that's the why of housing, why mediation in the housing space. There's so much fertile ground between rental providers and renters. There's so much win-win solution. And having been at this for 30 years in a community setting, I see it's not just win-win, but win-win-win. Our communities are impacted by housing instability. We get police calls to the apartment buildings that have the highest eviction rates. Our schools are struggling when they have a lot of turnover in their students. So the community wins, the renter wins, and the landlord wins when we can help find a, help them come up with a solution that will prevent an eviction. So the third part is why CMM, and Katie Arnold is gonna speak to that. And I'll just mention that one of our first forays into this area was with the working in partnership with Minnesota Housing, was with the COVID Housing Assistance Program, the CHAP program. And we pitched the idea that they allow us into this space providing rent assistance, and what we wanted to do was offer mediation. And we thought maybe we'd have 100 families across Minnesota that would take us up on it. Our site was up for 2 weeks, and we had 1,800 households from 77 counties in Minnesota who said, we want to work with this organization that's offering the mediation services. So we believed that it was something that would meet a need. We learned that it would. We've been doing that work ever since. And Katie?
Thank you. And if you could keep to about 2 minutes so we have time for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Howard, committee members. Thank you for having us here today. And I want to thank Representative Ajbaje for your support and for being the chief author on this bill. As my colleague Beth mentioned, my name is Katie Arnold. I'm the co-executive director of Community Mediation Minnesota. CMM is the umbrella organization of Minnesota's six state-certified community dispute resolution programs. We are deeply integrated in many of Minnesota's counties, court systems, schools, and communities. Our mission is to be a collaborative hub that amplifies access to and the impact of community-based mediation and restorative services throughout the state. We are dedicated to promoting accessible conflict resolution solutions. Our approach focuses on building bridges through language accessibility and accommodations for individuals with disabilities. By training mediators from within the communities we serve whenever possible, we create more responsive services. Additionally, we train volunteers from communities to serve as mediation representatives, ensuring our services are effectively represented by individuals from communities we support. Our six CDRP collaborative organizations actively seek feedback, which in turn informs our collective planning for programs, data collection, and management. Specifically, this bill, House File 497, will enable us to continue sharing successful and unsuccessful strategies, leverage CMM statewide partnerships and outreach, coordinate capacity building mediator training, aggregate data through a statewide database, and amplify the efficiency of the integration of housing mediation services further into all of our Minnesota housing ecosystems. So, why CMM? CMM is a statewide resource. CMM works with organizations that have been certified by the Supreme Court. This funding is restricted to organizations that only hold that certification. We provide the infrastructure utilizing technology to scale services to a statewide footprint while ensuring best practices and services. Number two, CMM ensures compliance and accountability. CMM manages the funding and compliance with Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We have a strong working relationship with them and a proven track record, having worked with them for over 6 years and through four different grant programs, CHAP, Rent Help MN, Minnesota Housing Stability Services, and now Stable Mediation, Stable Housing Mediation Services. Our programs and operation manager works closely with each of the community dispute resolution programs by reviewing all invoices, documentation, and statistical reporting. CMM is adaptable, working to meet the needs of Minnesotans as time changes circumstances. There's an increase in request for our services. From 2023 to 2025, our services for housing mediation and housing resource navigation have almost doubled. We're asking to continue our work uninterrupted with MHFA for all Minnesotans and to be part of their base budget. As you can see on our bill, we are asking for $2.2 million. However, the current program does run on about $1 million annually, which we would ask for to be in the base bill at least so that we continue our services uninterrupted.
Thank you. Member discussion, Ed Representative Nash on the list.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just really quick, want to make sure this is being laid over because we don't have targets yet. We don't, we have money, don't have money.
This is being laid over.
Okay. Yep. We'll talk more later then.
Any other members? I'll thank you for coming and delivering testimony and for your amazing work. It really is work that helps get to resolution and avoid some of the worst consequences we've seen when people are in crisis. So thank you. Representative Vajja, any final words to your bill?
No, thank you to the committee. I appreciate your time and attention to this, and hopefully we'll hear more as budget negotiations keep ongoing.
With that, the bill is laid over. We have no further business. We are adjourned.